And I'm going to finish this one little bit just so that I don't disappoint folks who really were looking forward to delving into this chapter, as I was, as I am. All right. Very brief conclusion of this too short excerpt of chapter 5. 1968 was born of hopes, at least as much as discontents, as with 1848. It too, 68, was a revolution against the counter-revolution represented by the U.S., by the U.S. organization of its world hegemony as of 1945. It too was an attempt to fulfill the original goals of the Russian Revolution, while very much an effort to overcome the limitations of that revolution. It too, therefore, was a sublation this time of 1917. The parallel goes farther. 1848 was a failure in France, a failure in the rest of Europe. So too was 1968. In both cases, the bubble of popular enthusiasm and radical innovation was burst within a relatively short period. In both cases, however, the political ground rules of the world system were profoundly and irrevocably changed as a result of the revolution. It was 1848 which institutionalized the old left, using the term broadly. And it was 1968 that institutionalized the new social movements. Looking forward, 1848 was in this sense the great rehearsal for the Paris Commune and the Russian Revolution, for the Baku Congress and Bandung. 1968 was the rehearsal for what? The lesson that oppressed groups learned from 1848 was that it would not be easy to transform the system, and that the likelihood that spontaneous uprisings would in fact be able to accomplish such a transformation was rather small. Two things seemed clear as a result. The states were sufficiently bureaucratized and appropriately organized to function well as machineries to put down rebellions. Occasionally, because of wars or internal political divisions among powerful strata, their repressive machinery might buckle, and a revolution seemed to be possible. But the machineries could usually be pulled together quickly enough to put down the putative or abortive revolution. Secondly, the states could easily be controlled by the powerful strata through a combination of the latter's economic strength, their political organization, and their cultural hegemony, to use Gramsci's term of a later period. My interjection, economic strength, political organization, cultural hegemony, the triptych of power's control. Is this neat summary useful for designing a popular global strategy? Continuing. Since the states could control the masses and the powerful strata could control the states, it was clear that a serious effort of social transformation would require counter-organization, both politically and culturally. It is this perception that led to the formation for the first time of bureaucratically organized anti-systemic movements with relatively clear middle-term objectives. These movements, in their two great variants of the social and the national movement, began to appear on the scene after 1848, and their numbers, geographic spread, and organizational efficiency grew steady in the century that followed. What 1848 accomplished, therefore, was the historic turning of anti-systemic forces toward a fundamental political strategy, that of seeking the intermediate goal of obtaining state power, one way or another, as the indispensable way station on the road to transforming society and the world. To be sure, many argued against this strategy, but they were defeated in the debates. Over the following century, the opponents of this strategy grew weaker as the proponents of the strategy grew stronger. And this I'm seeing gets us back where we began, with Hegel and with his philosophy of national character, his philosophy of a hierarchy of states, suggests to me that his election on both right and left was a key tactic to contain, control, diffuse, and deflect our resistance. I suspect that the power of that day, which was forming, as Martin Bernal shows us, in the aftermath of the French Revolution, began to see that nation was no threat, was in fact a way to herd and keep us under control. Hegel did that for Frederick William, recall. You can read that story at the end of Revealing Division if you don't have volume 2 of Karl Popper's The Open Society and Its Enemies. A society that has been crafted for this long without our discussion represents severe containment of us. We've been caged so tightly, so thoroughly, that it's not a surprise our difficulty organizing at this juncture. Our heart has been broken many times. It's hard to believe in the possibility of global unity, particularly as they use relentlessly their strategy of infiltration and causing disharmony and dissension and despair internally. That's their key tactic. How do we overcome that? So it's no surprise that we have a hard time knowing how to start forming trust again in order to build the kind of unity we need. We the people, and I don't mean through our herders, the organizations that have been licensed specifically for that purpose to manage us. I mean we the people, we actual people have to do this. But the existence of the internet and the communication means for our global organizing exists now. New terms requires new hope, new sentiment, new conviction, the building of the certainty that we have finally arrived at the moment for our freedom. It's freedom time, and we can feel it, but we have to start acting on it. So get in touch, please. I don't mean to suggest that, and I'll edit this out, that I'm hanging on by my fingertips. Survival endurance mode, but if the shoe fits, I mean, it's beginning to feel like this. And again, I'll edit it out. But nonetheless, and I'm a talkative person, and it could be that some folk feel that there's no point because I just run off at the mouth. So create some ground rules. I'd be happy to facilitate rather than engage. The important thing is creating the tools. So, until next week, peace.